Hello, and welcome to the I've Got a Widow Sniffle in My Head edition of The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's episode is sponsored by Typekit. New from Adobe Typekit, we're not just on the web anymore. Adobe Typekit now brings great type directly onto your desktop for use in any application. Use desktop fonts from Typekit in any of your print, video, or other media projects, and they'll look as stunning as ever on the web, too. That's pretty amazing. Typekit works with quality Foundry partners to bring you a stunning collection of fonts for use in desktop applications and on your websites. Choose the fonts you need from a library featuring thousands of options, and then sync them to your desktop with Creative Cloud. Or use Typekit's service to host them on the web. Or do both, and bring a new level of consistency to the work you produce online and in print. That sounds great, Typekit. Thank you very much. With no further ado, today's guests are Philip Rayland and Roland Dubois, co-founders of Byte Department. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Hello.
Now, Byte Department, you're based in New York City, and you're a studio startup hybrid, in a sense, in that you create digital products, but you don't do it for yourselves, you do it for clients. So you're in client services and you're in product development, two flavors that don't usually go together. We're going to talk about how you got there and how that's going and what kind of, you know, how viable that business strategy is, and maybe what kind of person or developer or shop you'd need to be for that to work for you. You guys call yourselves a full stack development agency. What does that mean?
So we came up with the term full stack development agency after we noticed that a lot of our sort of onboarding, our client requests came from two sides. They came from the idea of they thought we were at one point a design agency or a standard advertising agency. And then from the other side, where people knew that we could build things, so they would ask us for development work, where they wanted us to just code out things.
So the clients that you get are from ad agencies, from, they're not startup companies looking for someone to make an app for them, or are they?
Yeah, so we actually have two ideal kind of clients. One, we partner with traditional agencies who need a little bit more manpower behind tech, who don't really understand the mobile space exactly. It's not their job, but they know that they need to sell it and they want to sell it to their clients.
When you say agencies, do you mean companies that make websites, or do you mean mainly ad agencies, or a mix of both?
Yeah, the ad creative industry. The people who are making Facebook campaigns or, you know, doing things a little bit aggressive in social media and really want to kind of capture the mobile market.
Right. Okay. So there's already a campaign in many cases that exists, I would assume, when you guys come in.
Yeah, there's usually a campaign, a concept, or a client who is just trying to figure out a way to get into it. That's probably an oversimplification, but yes, they typically have an idea. They come to us, and then we work directly with them on building a product, if that makes sense. Ideas and products are two different ideas.
Okay. How do they find you? How do these clients find you?
We've been very lucky to just build our entire company off of referrals. We found that we met one contact who worked for one agency. She left her job, went to another agency. And every time we build another relationship there, it just kind of snowballs, which I think is kind of a testament to the fact that there is a large market for the services we provide. Just the fact that, you know, we went from one agency to several, and all of them are, you know, requesting the same kind of work, or, you know, what, knowing they needed it and using us to help provide it for them.
As you guys, as Byte Department became more and more proficient at making digital products for other people, did it occur to you, maybe we should do this for ourselves? Have you made products for yourselves?
Yes, we definitely toyed with the idea. There's lots of code that's been written and a lot of good ideas that are stored in Google Docs at this point that we know how to build, we know how to solve it. And one thing that I think we've discovered internally is that our I guess one of our larger weaknesses, at least at this point, has always been the idea that we didn't know how to market it. We know how to build it. We know how to construct it in the most flexible, you know, intelligent way possible. But we were never really great at the self-promotion side of it. We really wanted to build something and then move on to the next project.
Like a studio, like an agency.
Exactly. And, you know, things work really well when you have PR firms and all of these things in there. And, like, that was never our goal. We're perpetually curious. And the agency model kind of met the personalities specifically of Roland and myself.
So you pivoted into product development and then pivoted back out?
Yeah. Roland and I built an app many, many, many years ago, back when the company was very brand new, not even called Byte Department. And it tracked where food trucks were. And we built this app because we wanted to know how to build apps. Frankly, if you ask me what it was grad school for both of us.
It
was beautiful. We put more energy into it than anybody ever should have. But at the same point, we also kind of funded our software development know-how through it. We didn't know how to build iPhone apps. We didn't know how to build Ruby on Rails apps. We didn't know how to organize projects for production or to manage teams of people, because no iPhone app gets built with one person. And, like, we spent all of the time, and, you know, poor Roland, he spent so many hours making everything so perfect.
Roland, how did you learn all that stuff?
Mostly through searching online. You figure it out. You have a problem, and then you find a way how to solve it.
Google University.
Yeah, no, not really. More like Stack Overflow.
Okay. You just go to Stack Overflow whenever you don't know how to do something.
Yes. So, I mean, one part of that website was to have people, to give people an API to integrate a map of their actual food trucks on their location. So a big part was that to understand how Google Maps worked and how to integrate it into an iframe and how other services use iframe map services and stuff like that. And so I was looking, learning, copying, and doing it better.
You did the food truck service at the same time that Monkey Do, who were on the show a couple weeks ago, had their own. And those were the only two. And now you guys share a studio space, which is crazy to me. But you were both making food truck apps at the same time, and you both kind of quit at the same time. They were both really good, and then you just, was it too much to maintain? I mean, is this part of losing interest in product development as a full-time?
Well, I don't want to speak for Mike or Tim, but I think that probably none of us were super passionate about food trucks. Right? We had an idea. We liked it. It was an interesting problem to solve, and definitely one that everybody was talking about in 2008 and 2009.
If you lived in Austin, you would have gotten funding.
Yeah, well, and the truth is we debated the idea of getting funding and then decided that that wasn't actually what we wanted to do. We didn't want to spend the next 5 years of our lives trying to raise enough funding in order to sell the company for probably the same amount of money we raised.
New York just isn't a food truck scene as much as some other cities.
Food trucks also have a unique issue in the sense that they're all small businesses.
Right.
So it's like herding cats. And, like, in order to do it, you would have to build a very large sales staff to, like, right, maintain and onboard all of those cats.
It would be harder. It would be like Seamless or something, but instead of a Chinese restaurant with five people and an owner, you're dealing with, like, two guys in the back of a truck and millions of them.
Yeah, it's just it's a unique problem to solve, and also I think when at the height of it, we still hadn't figured out geolocation.
How did you guys figure out geolocation?
So we didn't. We took it from the angle of how can we create sort of a positive side for the vendors themselves. How can we solve one problem for them? And that problem was. The problem was specific to the idea that they were all maintaining websites, and those websites had schedules on them, and those schedules had to be updated constantly.
So sending the idea of sending an API to a guy who runs a food truck doesn't seem very promising.
No, so what we did was we created a back-end system that provided a scheduler. It was a full schedule system based off of locations. Users would log in, they would put in their weekly schedule, which is how they were, most trucks were managing it.
They still have to license the space, right? It's not, they're exactly. Not pirates. So.
Yeah, it's not free for all. There's a structure behind it. It doesn't seem very obvious, but each city has some rules and the food trucks have to apply by it.
Yeah, so actually that does seem pretty manageable. But you decided, you know, not to go after funding, and at the same time, the food truck craze was, you know, food trucks stopped being like a hot new thing or a hot old thing that was new again, but and became just part of the fabric of life. And
yeah, they were no longer the destination that they once were. I remember reading the articles and seeing a couple of them starting to go bankrupt or close, and then realizing it was like, that's probably a good time to think about this fad is coming to a close or at least evening itself out.
You've also made liquor products, but for liquor companies.
Yeah, we've had liquor companies hire us to come up with lifestyle products, I think is the word for it.
What's the, you made an app that takes a picture of me and a picture of you at the same time, like using the front and back camera? Is that right?
Yeah, we built an app with an agency that it was before Front Back came out. Front Back was much more popular than this app was. But the idea was to use both pieces of hardware at the same time and to sort of capture that relationship of me being in the photo as well as the people who are on the front side of the camera naturally in the photo.
And bike department, you built for yourself, right?
Yes. Yeah.
What is that?
So Bike Department aggregates the 40 or so bike share systems in North America and pulls them in to a back-end system that basically calculates against trending. It does a lot of compensation for... So bike feeds, give you a little bit of background. Bike feeds are updated every minute or so.
Just go even further back. This is for the like city bike, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Where a city has bicycles all over the place and you can...
Yeah. So all of the major cities at this point have it. You know, right. There's V-Bikes in Chicago, and then I'm trying to remember all of the names of them.
It's City Bikes here in New York, I think.
Yeah, City Bike
the blue
here.
Ones, yeah, like from Citibank, sponsored by Citibank.
Capital Bike in Washington, D.C. All of the major metropolitan areas at this point have them.
And most of them have apps, but they're not very good. Is that why you wanted to build your own?
Actually, a large portion of them don't have dedicated apps, which is
really
the part. Yeah, there's a couple of bike shares like Miami, Florida. They have a bike share and there's no dedicated app at this point. The page on there says coming soon.
Okay. So. But it, in most cities, I mean, you want to know before you walk 8 blocks, or actually they're in New York, they're every block, but before you go somewhere, you want to know, will there be a bike there for me when I get there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that's basically what we do is we pull in the data, store it, understand the trending of the data, how quickly are bikes leaving, how quickly are bikes coming back. Because when you rent a bike, you have two problems. One is there a bike, and two is there going to be a spot when I'm done with the bike. So
you're actually predicting the future to some extent. Like you're showing what you think the situation will be by the time the person gets there.
Exactly. And rather than think about it in the sense of how many bikes are physically there, how many docks, and sort of thinking about that, we changed the UI to be more of like, you know, a stoplight. Green means go. Lighter green means you're really quite likely to do this. Yellow means walk by that station on your way to another one. And then red means just don't even try it. Move somewhere else.
So traffic lights, something that your audience will understand immediately. And are you using Google Maps? What are the pretty maps that you guys are using in the application?
So it's a native iOS application, so we tied into Apple's Map Kit.
Okay, so every once in a while, things are inaccurate.
Well, one thing about the feed itself is that it's not a perfect feed. The feed doesn't recognize broken bikes or broken docks. That is a very frustrating thing. If you're on a bike and you're looking for a dock, the last thing you want is to find broken docks and have to go to the next station.
Right.
So that was one thing that Mike, our developer, he was trying to solve this issue. And the way that he solved this issue is that he averages out the intensity of how this station is used, how many bikes get in, how many bikes get out, and then if there's always one bike left, the chances that it's broken is very high, so we just take it out of the equation. And that's how we, like, with algorithm, make a more precise prediction of docks and bikes available to the user.
What is the scientific principle behind that? I would have no idea. Leaving aside all the technology, right? Leaving aside the technology that you're wrangling, just the thinking that we have this UX problem, we have this experience problem that a bike might not be there in 20 minutes, and we solve that with this predictive algorithm. How do you, is there something, like my kid's in third grade, and there's like the commutative property of multiplication or something. I can just go, oh yeah, okay, that's a science rule. It has a name. It doesn't take a genius to understand it. Is there anything like that? I mean, I would have no idea how to do what you just...
I think that our algorithm was built entirely around the idea of understanding the minimums and the minimums and the heights of the numbers that were returned to us, and then making a lot of assumptions until we got it right.
Especially over time.
Who made this look so pretty? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, you add more things to the equation to make it more precise. So if you have, like, over a period of an hour, always the same dock left, then chances are no one is using it, so you can take it out. So we add time into the equation.
How big are you guys now?
We are hiring our eighth employee at the moment.
So it started out just the two of you, co-founders.
Yep,
2 years ago.
And you both, well, Philip, I know your background is in graphic design. And then you moved into development and became and from there to management. How did that work? And Roland, what's your guys' background? Let's back up.
So I went to school for newspaper design.
Wow.
Which is something they were still selling in 2006. And went to school, graduated.
Well, they teach Latin too. I mean, it's okay.
Yeah, it's true. The poor guy who runs my old program, he gets emails from me constantly asking him to stop teaching Flash to the kids, but that's a different story.
Oh, man.
So I did a newspaper background and moved to New York, got a job at a publishing company designing magazines, and then kind of got curious with WordPress. So I installed myself a WordPress blog, which didn't have a lot of great content on it, but I used it kind of to jump into it.
Sure.
And got a unique opportunity one day from a woman who called me randomly asking me if I wanted to come do production at an agency that did a little bit of web. I said yes, started the job there, and met Roland on day one, at which point I came in and tenaciously broke the WordPress blog that the company had just spent 5 months building.
Deliberately?
No, on accident. Roland saved my butt. Literally, like,
did
I thought
you put
I
an image tag in the middle of a paragraph tag or something? What did you do? How can you break WordPress? Is pretty solid. What did you do?
It's like WordPress 1.0.
Okay.
Many years ago. I mean, this was 2007.
Yeah.
You know, not WordPress 1.0, but definitely a young version of it. And I think I got too tenacious with open source plugins. Poor Roland didn't know PHP at the time, but he's still. I remember just like the hot sweat pouring down my face as I looked at the blog that these guys had just spent so much money building, and thinking like, I'm going to get fired. I don't have a job today.
You're brand new to the job and you've just destroyed 5 months worth of work. And Roland, you bailed him out?
Well, the point was I wasn't really that proficient in PHP, so they outsourced the development to a third party vendor, and they just finished the design on and the production of it. So I was in charge of like making sure that the data is there, and Philip was installing some plugins that weren't meant to be there. And
that's usually the problem. If you have a problem in WordPress, it's usually because you installed a plugin. They should have, but you guys didn't tell them no plugins. Talk to us first if you want to do something.
No, the people, our old bosses, didn't even know what happened.
Okay, and so were you guys siloed until this happened? Were you did you work in separate departments and not talk to each other before this happened?
Oh, so that was, it was a small team. There were only, I think, 12 people at the company at the time. So basically, we just kind of lied our way through it, and I bought Roland as much time as I possibly could by telling, I don't even, like, stories nobody wanted to hear. Very much like one of those, like, you know.
Like a sitcom.
Exactly. One of those sitcoms where I'm standing in the doorway trying to block somebody from looking inside of it.
You're Liz Lemon keeping the wedding going so Jack can keep his girlfriend from leaving.
Exactly.
Great. So you became friends at that point? You sort of found each other and said, I mean, I have had situations like that in work of finding someone and immediately going, yeah, this is the person who compliments me. This is the person I need to work with. I like this person. Was it like that right away for you guys or no?
I would say, yeah.
And how soon until you launched your own business?
So off the record,
we're on the record.
I know, I'm teasing. sorry. The company that we work for didn't fare so well after the 2008 financial crisis. And there was a lot of opportunity at that point to kind of take time off or take unpaid time off and, you know, go do things. So over the course of the time, Roland and I started picking up freelance work on the side. In the sense that, you know, we would do little sites here or there. We built a lot of stuff for ourselves. I think at one point we built a generator that would put a panda bear on a website. We saw anyone's website. We saw that the thing where you could put bacon on somebody's website, and right. I walked in and I was like, well, and let's build one that does pandas. We spent a whole week in that week just puzzling it out.
So your job is to go, yeah, we should put pandas on everything, and his job is to make that happen.
Yeah, we fell into that pattern, the poor guy. We fell into the pattern of me being like, Roland, why don't you learn PHP? Roland, you should get good at JavaScript. Roland, we should figure out what responsive design is. And then him just having to deliver it. Basically, I sell it, and then he delivers.
So you're both strategic now, though, with 8 employees, right? With a staff of 8 people, you're both more strategic. Roland, you're not all the time still hand-coding everything, are you? Or are you?
I am still very much on the production side, but I have a lot of hands that can help me now, especially if I'm stuck somewhere or I know that this is very simple to solve and I just have too much on my own desk. So, yeah, but more and more we pivot into the management of things. That's how it works.
That's the curse of a design and development career. Right, or really any career, I guess. After you, if you're good at something for long enough, people promote you, or you promote yourself.
Yeah, Roland's really been helping keep quality. Right,
that's,
you know,
a good
we were a small team who made a name for ourselves by producing things that most small teams couldn't produce, and he's been very integral in just keeping quality rolling in the same level that it always has been when he was producing it. Or teaching the other employees exactly how to do what needs to get done.
Going back to bike department just for a minute, it's still selling. It sells pretty well, I think, right?
Yeah.
It's free, but then what, you pay a small fee to remove the ads? Is that how?
Yep. For some cities where we're not against the API for selling things, you can pay 99 cents to have the ads off of it. Hilariously, from a business standpoint, that app has sold us a lot of custom work. You know, like, we built it and people like it. People like the process behind it. They like the story. And it sells in the sense that it kind of continually helps qualify us in order to build other people's projects.
So you use your products as the way other studios might use their traditional portfolio.
They're exactly.
Just out there. And it says, not all over the app, but, you know, it says the login screen, the sign-in screen that's up for a minute says presented by Byte Department. And people find you through that?
Yeah, we get a lot of web traffic through that app. It's interesting. We added some tags to the URL so that when you're loading up the website from it, you know, it shows us the traffic. And I mean, from that perspective, yes, people contact us about it. We get a lot of crazy emails from people, which is always fun from the product side. And then from just a sales side, because it's a concept that's easy enough for most people to understand, right? It's a four-screen app. There's not a huge amount of data going on. Right. But it does our full stack selling.
What do you – okay, I want to go back to that. You talked about being a full stack development agency. Explain what that means. I think now we have a good sense of what you do. I probably asked that prematurely. But I think we have a good sense of what you do now. What does full stack development agency mean?
Okay. So when we work with a new client or a client that doesn't have, let's say, a very obvious roadmap, right? People come to us, they have ideas, and then it's our job to sell them products. So they come to us with an idea, and when they do that, I look at them, or I try to talk to them, and I say, here's what we are. We're full stack. And by full stack, I mean we're going to work with you on four very specific kinds of strategies. The first strategy, and probably the one that people relate with the most, is the concept of experience. We assume experience to be both how the app works, what the app does, and how it looks. The visual layer of it, you know, I like to say this and it doesn't make everybody super happy. I assume that the visual layer is always the one that can change the most and the one that doesn't need, like, we need to spend some energy on it, but it is the thing that should evolve and should evolve as often as possible. But experience and product are super important concepts. To know what you're building and why you're building it and how users are going to use it is, you know, functionally the thing people understand the most about digital products. Once you have a handle on the experience strategy, we move into platform strategy. Platform strategy is everything to do with the back-end systems. It's how is data going to be interpreted and returned back to your user. It varies by project, right? Some platform strategies are as simple as a WordPress install, right? How do you need a CMS system, WordPress, that works for you. Others are much larger APIs with, you know, Ruby on Rails backend systems and, you know, templating and all the things go along with it. So we talk to our clients about experience. Then we talk to them about platform. And make sure that those strategies and those concepts are thought of as different deliverables. The third one that we ask them about is mobile. And we put mobile in its own column, not because platforms don't have mobile strategies, but because products have mobile strategies. And the idea here is sometimes you want a native app, sometimes you don't need mobile strategy, sometimes you need a responsive website. All of those fall into how are we going to target users on mobile devices. The last one, and the one that people don't typically assume to be its own strategy, is integration. The web is getting more complex, platforms are getting more complex, and when you do things like tie in with Facebook OAuth or Foursquare API, those are integration strategies. What kind of data can I get from this service? What is the experience going to be like for our user? And if that service stops existing, how will it affect my platform and my product?
So, in other words, so some people, you guys are familiar with the indie web movement, which says, like, I may use Twitter, but I'll publish my tweet on my website first. I own it, and then I'll let it, and then I'll send it to Twitter, or I'll publish my photos on my website first, and then I'll send them to Instagram or Flickr, right? But this is kind of the opposite of that. This is saying, look, these services are out here. We're not going to reinvent the wheel. Every time we need to build something, we're going to be tapping into Foursquare or Facebook or someone else's API. But what's our strategy if that goes out of business? What's our strategy if they walk away? In other words, you're building a house in on the San Andreas Fault and saying, what's our strategy if there's an earthquake? What will the house do to protect the occupants?
Exactly. And, you know, integration with third-party systems like Foursquare API is usually a very easy, very direct solution for a lot of new products, right? People don't have the opportunity to go out and index 50 million world, right. world locations. So you sort of look at it that way. We do a lot of map work, and maps are always kind of like interesting because you don't want empty maps. People want data on maps. And if there isn't data on maps, they really want that product.
This is why before they developed their own map, Apple, that's, I mean, it's a perfect example. Apple's a big company. They ultimately wanted to create their own maps, but first they tested the waters. Mm-hmm. They used Google's map as long as they could, and then they said, all right, if we're really going to do stuff with this, we're going to have to bite the bullet and make our own. So what you're saying here is to launch a product initially, it may make perfect sense to just use a third-party system, like something from Foursquare, and what that's capable and not capable of, and accept these are the capabilities I get from that platform. But then if the app were to really take off, take a life of its own, then you might look at, okay, maybe now we have to do something custom. Does that make sense? Is that what you're saying? Am I getting that right?
Exactly. And to kind of like tie it all around, we can talk about the bike department app.
Okay.
Specifically because like if we look at the experience, the problem we were trying to solve was one, the traditional apps that were created by these systems had bad UI. So we fixed that. From a product standpoint, we looked at it and we said, you know, we're going to reinterpret data. This data is out there. Nobody's, you know, it's not a new idea to put bike share data on a map, but we're going to look at it from a making the data quality, making the data better. That's what we solved in the product strategy. The platform strategy was a Ruby on Rails application that imported all of this data and put it, organized it against, organized it against trending data. How can we sort of run this data against what happened last week and produce better feeds?
Great.
Our mobile strategy there had everything to do with it was a native application, native iOS. We just started there.
Did you ever port it to anything else?
No, not yet. We're working on a couple of different versions right now in our free time. We've given our lead mobile developer a lot of leeway in the last couple of months of learning other platforms, and he's been using that as the direct learning tool.
Well, people say there are many more Android devices sold than iPhones and iPads, but the most apps that are bought and used are on the iOS platform for whatever reason. Whether it's the demographic of who buys which product or what. But so it kind of makes sense to still focus on iOS.
Yeah, iOS has a lot of benefits. You know, we do a lot of different kinds of work on different platforms, and they all have their own benefits. For this product, for this project, it made a lot of sense to do iOS first.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause we can scale it quickly. It doesn't require a lot of thinking on our part. You know, we had all of the resources directly in-house and kind of ready to roll.
Okay, so your mobile strategy was native iOS, and your integration strategy was what?
That was connecting to the 40 or so feeds across the United States. So we went through, we found all of the XML files and the JSON feeds and all of the things that were existing regarding these bike shares. And we kind of just pulled them into the system. For the integration considerations, the first thing we really did was...
They're all formatted differently, I would assume.
Absolutely. So yeah, we had to harmonize them. And that's part of the integration strategy and, you know, ties directly into the platform. But also from that perspective, we needed to build an app that wasn't one feed dependent. If, let's say, New York City stops providing back the JSON feed for the bike share program here, then the app won't break. It'll just be available in 39 other cities.
Right. Have you guys worked with Google Glass at all?
Not yet. We actually just got our hands on it a couple of weeks ago. It was great. It's a lot of fun.
I've seen Luke Rebluski talk about how seemingly simple it is, but how fiendishly complex it really is. He does Polar, right? He makes the app where you basically, it's like a hot or not for anything, as you're saying, or which is better, you know, paint my room white, paint my room off white, and people vote. I mean, that was a really boring example, but, you know, they bet on teams or whatever it is, not betting, but voting. But to do it with Google Glass was very difficult, and they ended up giving up, I think, because you have to analyze all this visual data and be able to highlight, you know, you're looking at two cars in a parking lot and you just want to take a picture of the two cars and go, is it the one on the left or the one on the right? But that's very complicated. I'm explaining it terribly, but it's very complicated to execute. Visually, we look at it and our minds understand it, but to actually convert deep data in a photograph into UX into a series of discrete designs steps was very difficult. So have you worked with any wearables at all?
No, not yet. We're getting our hands on a couple of the Samsung watches soon. I'm curious to see how they work and like sort of what you can run with them. The truth is that we've been so busy keeping up with everything that's currently available, we haven't had a ton of opportunity to look at 6 months from now.
You have your own, what do you call it? You've built a sort of a testing lab, right?
Yeah, we've been collecting devices.
We're working on it.
Yeah, we've definitely been collecting devices. We're running out of desk space.
What's your strategy for that? Is that, I mean, that can be quickly become overwhelming. I'll never have everything that's out there, and I can't. What do you do? What's your approach conceptually?
I think at this point for iOS, we kind of have everything covered. Although now we have a large collection of devices that are no longer relevant. You know, like an iPad 1, you probably don't need to do much testing on any longer. For the Android and the Windows Phone market, we've been purchasing higher-end devices and then lower-end devices.
Nothing in the middle.
Yeah, you know, this is probably not the best logic and definitely not a model for other people to think about it this way, but we've just been kind of covering our bases as they were requirements, acquiring things as we needed them.
What about a company like Samsung that makes something like 5,000 standard sizes of mobile, right? Like that are like 10 pixels different one after another. How do you, again, do you just pick like the biggest and the smallest that they make, and or what do you do?
Yeah, there's a lot of data on what's being used. Specifically in the Android market, I think you just target what you can responsibly. When we do estimates and things like this, you know, it's like, here's what we can do for this amount of money, and if you really want to sort of scale it into everything, then here's a line item list of how much energy we'll need to do it.
Have you ever had, I've had people who are using a really strange device tell me that there was a problem in my website, and it wasn't really a problem with, again, which is more straightforward more and less. I've had people say my website wasn't working properly or displaying properly in their crummy phone browser. And it's like, yeah, it uses web standards and interprets them correctly and was tested on all these other devices, but they're like, yeah, but on this device, do you have people come up to you and complain about stuff like that? Or you, as work for hire, do you know, like, this is basically a line item for your clients to worry about, not you?
Yeah, we're pretty forward about what it is we can support and what the pricing supports at the beginning. And truthfully, we do a lot of analytics on, for customers who have existing products or existing websites, I always request to look at their analytics and make a lot of decisions about support based off of it. I like data and I like responding to actual data rather than the sort of hypotheticals of like one person in Scandinavia looking at it on a 1996 tablet, whatever that might be.
What about web TV? Like the newer generations of web TV, have you had to integrate into that at all?
No, we have not jumped into that just yet.
Are you nervous or excited?
We're always excited. So long as we have an opportunity to learn something and a format to build in, then we're good to go.
If someone wants to follow your particular business path, someone else wants to say, yeah, we want to build apps, we might want to build our own app someday and get it funded and everything, but we'd like to spend the next 5 years building apps on the client's dime. So we would like to do what Byte Department does and just become masters at making apps to order. What would you recommend as training or preparation?
I would say, and the one thing that we've struggled with the most and are finally just getting good at the last, I'd say, year or two, is learning how to sell the idea of, or learning how to sell that ideas are not products, right? You have to get clients, you have to get people into the idea that what they're coming to you is not a product. They have an intention, they have a concept, but they don't have a product just yet. And if you're really serious about building products and selling iPhone applications and platforms to people, you need to help them get into the digital space and understand how it is these things operate.
Then I would say that what you've actually just said is that communications are the most important if you want to do what you guys do, right? I mean, obviously, if you're making an app for yourselves, presumably everyone on the team understands what digital products are and how what they can and can't do. And so there's no education involved. But if someone's bringing you an idea and they say, we've got this app, and what they mean is the creative director had an idea at lunch, you need to be able to, in a positive way, communicate with them that you're excited about their idea too, but it's still just an idea and there are various ways it might be implemented and various strategies of turning it into some kind of product. You have to be good at that, which I gather from Roland. I just want to make sure you're still awake. You there?
I'm here. I'm listening.
Yeah, because when I talk to you guys, Roland generally does the listening and you generally do the talking. So you need somebody like Roland who really is just capable of understanding, implementing, and teaching others to do the same. And you need someone like Philip to put it in client-friendly language.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think I mostly go too much into detail and then confuse clients that are not very much in the same in the same realm.
That's always with developers. That's classic.
Yeah, Roland tries to solve problems. I try to identify them.
Okay, that's nice too. That's nice too. They say that that's actually better with parenting too. You shouldn't try to solve your kids' problems. You should just help them understand what's happening and help them figure out their choices. And it's weird. I have this, I think a lot of guys have this where you want to just solve it right away. But to be a really good designer, you have to be a good listener and just try to understand the problem, not leap immediately to the solution.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's part of the what I was talking about just a second ago regarding understanding, you know, clients have ideas, and those ideas have immediate solutions, but they're not products. And getting them to the place where they actually know what they're solving and why they're solving it is the key to it.
How did you come up with the bike department logo? That'll be the last thing we discuss.
Yeah, that's all Roland.
Well, that is my wife, Penny's design.
Is it?
Yes.
It's beautiful and so funny. It's so distinctive. Listeners, it's the letter, it's a lowercase b and a lowercase d facing each other, looking kind of like glasses. And then there's a bracket because of code, and the bracket looks like a mustache. So it comes across almost like the Monopoly Man in hieroglyphics or the Monopoly Man in emoticons or something. It's really fun and friendly. And the color you picked because...
Penny picked it too.
Okay. We'll have to have her on the show next. Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen, Bike Department, Roland Dubois, Philip Brayland, and your team. Good luck with everything. Thank you for coming on the Big Web Show. Thank you, Typekit, for sponsoring today's broadcast. And happy holidays, all. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.